How did an apprentice armorer end up as a bridgeman, anyway? Kaladin asked as Leighton settled back down to work. He was a thick-armed man, stout and oval-faced with light hair. Craftsmen don't usually get thrown away. Leighton shrugged. When a piece of armor breaks and a Light Eyes takes an arrow in the shoulder, someone has to take the blame. I'm convinced my master keeps an extra apprentice, especially for those kinds of situation. Well, his loss is our good fortune. You're going to keep us alive. I'll do my best, sir. He smiled. Can't do much worse on the armor than you did yourself, though. It's amazing that breastplate didn't fall off halfway through. Kaladin patted the bridgeman on the shoulder, then left him to his work, surrounded by a small ring of topaz chips. Kaladin had gotten permission to bring them, explaining his men needed light to work on the armor. Nearby, Lopin, Rock, and Dabid were returning with another load of salvage. Sills zipped ahead, leading them. Kaladin walked down the chasm, a garnet sphere looped in a small leather carrier at his belt for light. The chasm branched here, making a large triangular intersection, a perfect place for spear training. Wide enough to give the men room to practice, yet far enough from any permanent bridges that scouts weren't likely to hear echoes. Kaladin gave the initial instructions each day, then let Teft lead the practice. The men worked by sphere light, small piles of diamond chips at the corners of the intersection, barely enough to see by. Never thought I'd envy those days practicing beneath the hot sun back in Amaram's army, he thought. He walked up to gap-toothed Hopper and corrected his stance, then showed him how to set his weight behind his spear thrusts. The bridgemen were progressing quickly, and the fundamentals were proving their merit. Some were training with the spear and the shield, practicing stances where they held lighter spears up beside the head with the shield raised. The most skilled were Scar and Moash. In fact, Moash was surprisingly good. Kaladin walked to the side, watching the hawk-faced man. He was focused, eyes intense, jaw set. He moved in attack after attack, the dozen spheres giving him an equal number of shadows. Kaladin remembered feeling such dedication. He'd spent a year like that after Tian's death, driving himself to exhaustion each day, determined to get better, determined never to let another person die because of his lack of skill. He'd become the best in his squad, then the best in his company. Some said he'd been the best spearman in Amaram's army. What would have happened to him if Terra hadn't coaxed him out of his single-minded dedication? Would he have burned himself out, as she'd claimed? Moash, Kaladin called. Moash paused, turning toward Kaladin. He didn't fall out of stance. Kaladin waved him to approach, and Moash reluctantly trotted over. Lopin had left a few waterskins for them, hanging by their cords from a cluster of haspers. Kaladin pulled a skin free, tossing it to Moash. The other man took a drink, then wiped his mouth. You're getting good, Kaladin said. You're probably the best we have. Thanks, Moash said. I've noticed you keep training when Teft lets the other men take breaks. Dedication is good, but don't work yourself ragged. I want you to be one of the decoys. Moash smiled broadly. Each of the men had volunteered to be one of the four who would join Kaladin distracting the Parshendi. It was amazing. Months ago, Moash, along with the others, had eagerly placed the new or the weak at the front of the bridge to catch arrows. Now, to a man, they volunteered for the most dangerous jobs. Do you realize what you could have in these men, Sadeus? Kaladin thought. If you weren't so busy thinking of how to get them killed? So what is it for you? Kaladin said, nodding toward the dim practice ground. Why do you work so hard? What is it you hunt? Vengeance, the other man said, face somber. Kaladin nodded. I lost someone once, because I wasn't good enough with the spear. I nearly killed myself practicing. Who was it? My brother. Moash nodded. The other bridgemen, Moash included, seemed to regard Kaladin's mysterious past with reverence. I'm glad I trained, Kaladin said, and I'm glad you're dedicated. But you have to be careful. If I'd gotten myself killed by working so hard, it wouldn't have meant anything.
Sure, but there's a difference between us, Kaladin.
Kaladin raised an eyebrow.
You wanted to be able to save someone. Me? I want to kill somebody.
Who? Moash hesitated, then shook his head.
Maybe I'll say someday.
He reached out, grabbing Kaladin on the shoulder.
I'd surrendered my plans, but you've returned them to me. I'll guard you with my life, Kaladin. I swear it to you, by the blood of my fathers.
Kaladin met Moash's intense eyes and nodded.
All right, then. Go help Hopper and Yake. They're still off on their thrusts.
Moash jogged off to do as told. He didn't call Kaladin sir, and didn't seem to regard him with the same unspoken reverence as the others. That made Kaladin more comfortable with him. Kaladin spent the next hour helping the men one by one. Most of them were overeager, throwing themselves into their attacks. Kaladin explained the importance of control and precision, which won more fights than chaotic enthusiasm. They took it in, listening. More and more they reminded him of his old spear squad. That set him thinking. He remembered how he had felt when originally proposing the escape plan to the men. He'd been looking for something to do, a way to fight, no matter how risky, a chance. Things had changed. He now had a team he was proud of, friends he had come to love, and a possibility, perhaps, for stability. If they could get the dodging and armor right, they might be reasonably safe, maybe even as safe as his old spear squad had been. Was running still the best option?
That is a worried face, a rumbling voice noted.
Kaladin turned as Rock walked up and leaned against the wall near him, folding powerful forearms.
Is the face of a leader, say I. Always troubled.
Rock raised a bushy red eyebrow.
Sadeus will never let us go, particularly not now that we're so prominent.
Alethi Light Eyes considered it reprehensible for a man to let slaves escape. It made him seem impotent. Capturing those who ran away was essential to save face.
You said this thing before, Rock said. We will fight the men he sends after us. We'll seek Garbranth, where there are no slaves. From there, the peaks, to my people who will welcome us as heroes.
We might beat the first group, if he's foolish and sends only a few dozen men. But after that he'll send more. And what of our wounded? Do we leave them here to die? Or do we take them with us and go that much more slowly?
Rock nodded slowly.
You are saying that we need a plan?
Yes, Kaladin said. I guess that's what I'm saying. Either that, or we stay here. As bridgemen.
Ha!
Rock seemed to take it as a joke.
Despite new armor, we would die soon. We make ourselves targets.
Kaladin hesitated. Rock was right. The bridgemen would be used day in and day out. Even if Kaladin slowed the death toll to 2 or 3 men a month, once he would have considered that impossible, but now it seemed within reach. Bridge 4, as it was currently composed, would be gone within a year.
I will talk with Sigzil about this thing,
Rock said, rubbing his chin between the sides of his beard.
We will think. There must be a way to escape this trap. A way to disappear. A false trail? A distraction? Perhaps we can convince Sadeus that we have died during Bridge Run.
How do we do that?
Don't know, Rock said. But we will think.
He nodded to Kaladin and sauntered off toward Sigzil. The Azish man was practicing with the others. Kaladin had tried speaking to him about Hoid, but Sigzil, typically close-mouthed, hadn't wanted to discuss it.
Hey, Kaladin,
Scar called. He was part of an advanced group that was going through Teft's very carefully supervised sparring.
Come spar with us. Show these rock-brained fools how it's really done.
The others began calling for him as well. Kaladin waved them down, shaking his head. Teft trotted over, a heavy spear on one shoulder.
Lad, he said quietly, I think it would be good for their morale if you showed them a thing or two yourself.
I've already given them instruction.
With a spear you knock the head off of. Going very slowly, with lots of talk. They need to see it, lad. See you.
We've been through this, Teft.
Well, so we have.
Kaladin smiled. Teft was careful not to look angry or belligerent. He looked as if he were having a normal conversation with Kaladin.
You've been a sergeant before, haven't you?
Never mind that. Come on. Just show them a few simple routines.
No, Teft, Kaladin said more seriously. Teft eyed him.
Are you going to refuse to fight on the battlefield, just like that horn eater?
It's not like that.
Well, what is it like?
Kaladin reached for an explanation. I'll fight when the time comes. But if I let myself get back into it now, I'll be too eager. I'll push to attack now. I'll have trouble waiting until the men are ready. Trust me, Teft. Teft studied him.
You're scared of it, lad.
What?
No, I can see it, Teft said. And I've seen it before. Last time you fought for someone you failed, eh? So now you hesitate to take it up again.
Kaladin paused. Yes, he admitted. But it was more than that. When he fought again, he would have to become that man from long ago. The man who had been called Stormblessed. The man with confidence and strength. He wasn't certain he could be that man any longer. That was what scared him. Once he held that spear again, there would be no turning back.
Well, Teft rubbed his chin. When the time comes, I hope you're ready. Because this lot will need you.
Kaladin nodded, and Teft hurried back to the others, giving some kind of explanation to mollify them.
Sixty-four. A Man of Extremes. They come from the pit. Two dead men. A heart in their hands, and I know that I have seen true glory. Kakasha, 1173. 13 seconds pre-death. A rickshaw puller.
I couldn't decide if you were interested or not,
Navani said softly to Dalinar, as they slowly walked around the grounds of Elikar's raised field palace.
Half the time you seemed like a flirt, offering hints at courtship, then backing away. The other half of the time I was certain I had misread you. And Gavilar was so forthcoming. He always did prefer to seize what he wished.
Dalinar nodded thoughtfully. He wore his blue uniform, while Navani was in a subdued maroon dress with a thick hem. Elikar's gardeners had begun to cultivate the plant life here. To their right, a twisting length of yellow shale bark rose to waist height like a railing. The stone-like plant was overgrown by small bunches of haspers, with pearly shells slowly opening and closing as they breathed. They looked like tiny mouths, silently speaking in rhythm with one another. Dalinar and Navani's pathway took a leisurely course up the hillside. Dalinar strolled with hands clasped behind his back. His honor guard and Navani's clerks followed behind. A few of them looked perplexed at the amount of time Dalinar and Navani were spending with one another. How many of them suspected the truth? All? Part? None? Did it matter?
I didn't mean to confuse you all those years ago, he said, voice soft to keep it from prying ears. I had intended to court you, but Galavar expressed a preference for you. So eventually I felt I had to step aside.
Just like that?
Navani asked. She sounded offended.
He didn't realize that I was interested. He thought that by introducing you to him, I was indicating that he should court you. That was often how our relationship worked.
I would discover people Gavilar should know, then bring them to him. I didn't realize until too late what I had done in giving you to him.
Giving me? Is there a slave's brand on my forehead of which I've been unaware?
I did not mean...
Oh, hush,
Navani said, her voice suddenly fond. Dalinar stifled a sigh. Though Navani had matured since their youth, her moods always had changed as quickly as the seasons. In truth, that was part of her allure.
Did you often step aside for him?
Navani asked. Always.
Didn't that grow tiresome?
I didn't think about it much, Dalinar said. When I did, yes, I was frustrated. But it was Gavilar. You know how he was. That force of will, that air of natural entitlement. It always seemed to surprise him when someone denied him or when the world itself didn't do as he wished. He didn't force me to defer. It was simply how life was. Navani nodded in understanding. Regardless, Dalinar said, I apologize for confusing you. I had difficulty letting go. I fear that, on occasion, I let too much of my true feelings slip out.
Well, I suppose I can forgive that, she said. Though you did spend the next 2 decades making certain I thought you hated me.
I did nothing of the sort.
Oh? And how else was I to interpret your coldness, the way you would often leave the room when I arrived?
Containing myself, Dalinar said. I had made my decision.
Well, it looked a lot like hatred, Navani said. Though I did wonder several times what you were hiding behind those stony eyes of yours. Of course, then shh came along.
As always, when the name of his wife was spoken, it came to him as the sound of softly rushing air, then slipped from his mind immediately. He could not hear or remember the name.
She changed everything, Navani said. You truly seemed to love her.
I did, Dalinar said. Surely he had loved her, hadn't he? He could remember nothing. What was she like? He quickly added, I mean, in your opinion. How did you see her?
Everyone loved, Navani said. I tried hard to hate her, but in the end I could only be mildly jealous.
You? Jealous of her? Whatever for?
Because, Navani said, she fit you so well, never making inappropriate comments, never bullying those around her, always so calm.
Navani smiled.
Thinking back, I really should have been able to hate her. But she was just so nice. Though she wasn't very... well...
What? Dalinar asked.
Clever,
Navani said. She blushed, which was rare for her.
I'm sorry, Dalinar, but she just wasn't. She wasn't a fool, but... well, not everyone can be cunning. Perhaps that was part of her charm.
She seemed to think that Dalinar would be offended.
It's all right, he said. Were you surprised that I married her?
Who could be surprised? As I said, she was perfect for you.
Because we were matched intellectually, Dalinar said dryly.
Hardly. But you were matched in temperament. For a time after I got over trying to hate her, I thought that the four of us could be quite close. But you were so stiff toward me.
I could not allow any further lapses to make you think that I was still interested.
He said the last part awkwardly. After all, wasn't that what he was doing now? Lapsing? Navani eyed him.
There you go again.
What?
Feeling guilty. Dalinar, you are a wonderful, honorable man, but you really are quite prone to self-indulgence.
Guilt? As self-indulgence? I never considered it that way before.
She smiled deeply.
What?
He asked.
You really are genuine, aren't you, Dalinar?
I try to be, he said. He glanced over his shoulder. Though the nature of our relationship continues to perpetuate a kind of lie.
We've lied to nobody. Let them think or guess what they wish.
I suppose you are right.
I usually am.
She fell silent for a moment.
Do you regret what we have—
No, Dalinar said sharply, the strength of his objection surprising him. Navani just smiled. No, Dalinar continued more gently. I do not regret this, Navani. I don't know how to proceed, but I am not going to let go. Navani hesitated beside a growth of tiny fist-sized rock buds, with their vines out like long green tongues. They were grouped almost like a bouquet, growing on a large oval stone placed beside the pathway.
I suppose it's too much to ask for you to not feel guilty, Navani said. Can't you let yourself bend just a little?
I'm not certain if I can. Particularly not now. Explaining why would be difficult.
Could you try to? For me?
Well, I'm a man of extremes, Navani. I discovered that when I was a youth. I've learned repeatedly that the only way to control those extremes is to dedicate my life to something. First it was Gavilar. Now it's the codes and the teachings of Noadon. They're the means by which I bind myself, like the enclosure of a fire, meant to contain and control it. He took a deep breath. I'm a weak man, Navani. I really am. If I give myself a few feet of leeway, I burst through all of my prohibitions. The momentum of following the codes these years, after Gavilar's death, is what keeps me strong. If I let a few cracks into that armor, I might return to the man I once was. A man I never want to be again. A man who had contemplated murdering his own brother for the throne, and for the woman who had married that brother. But he couldn't explain that, didn't dare let Navani know what his desire for her had once almost driven him to do. On that day, Dalinar had sworn that he could never hold the throne himself. That was one of his restraints. Could he explain how she, without trying, pried at those restraints? How it was difficult to reconcile his long-fermenting love for her with his guilt at finally taking for himself what he'd long ago given up for his brother?
You are not a weak man, Dalinar, Navani said.
I am. But weakness can imitate strength if bound properly, just as cowardice can imitate heroism if given nowhere to flee.
But there's nothing in Gavilar's book that prohibits us. It's just tradition that...
It feels wrong, Dalinar said. But please, don't worry. I do enough worrying for both of us. I will find a way to make this work. I just ask your understanding. It will take time. When I display frustration, it is not with you, but with the situation.
I suppose I can accept that. Assuming you can live with the rumors. They're starting already.
They won't be the first rumors to plague me, he said. I'm starting to worry less about them and more about Elokar. How will we explain to him?
I doubt he'll notice,
Navani said, snorting softly, resuming her walk. He followed.
He's so fixated on the Parshendi and occasionally the idea that someone in camp is trying to kill him.
This might feed into that, Dalinar said. He could read a number of conspiracies out of the two of us entering a relationship.
Well, he...
Horns began sounding loudly from below. Dalinar and Navani stopped to listen and identify the call.
Stormfather, Dalinar said. That's the tower itself, where a chasm fiend has been seen. It's one of the plateaus Sadeus has been watching.
Dalinar felt a surge of excitement.
My princes have failed every time to win a gem heart there. It will be a major victory if he and I can do it together.
Navani looked troubled.
You're right about him, Dalinar. We do need him for our cause. But keep him at arm's length.
Wish me the wind's favor.
He reached toward her, but then stopped himself. What was he going to do? Embrace her here in public? That would set off the rumors like fire across a pool of oil. He wasn't ready for that yet. Instead, he bowed to her, then hastened off to answer the call and collect his shard plate. It wasn't until he was halfway down the path that he paused to consider Navani's choice of words. She had said, "We need him for our cause." What was their cause? He doubted that Navani knew either. But she had already started to think of them as together in their efforts. And, he realized, so did he. The horns called, such a pure and beautiful sound to signify the imminence of battle. It caused a frenzy in the lumberyard. The orders had come down. The tower was to be assaulted again, the very place where Bridge 4 had failed, the place where Kaladin had caused a disaster. Largest of the plateaus, most coveted. Bridgemen ran this way and that for their vests. Carpenters and apprentices rushed out of the way. Matal shouted orders. An actual run was the only time he did that without Hashal. Bridge leaders, showing a modicum of leadership, bellowed for their teams to line up. A wind whipped the air, blowing wood chips and bits of dried grass into the sky. Men yelled, bells rang. And into this chaos strode Bridge 4, Kaladin at their head. Despite the urgency, soldiers stopped, bridgemen gaped, carpenters and apprentices stilled. 35 men marched in rusty orange carapace armor, expertly crafted by Leighton to fit onto leather jerkins and caps. They'd cut off arm guards and shin guards to complement the breastplates. The helms were built from several different headpieces, and had been ornamented, at Leighton's insistence, with ridges and cuts, like tiny horns or the edges of a crab's shell. The breastplates and guards were ornamented as well, cut into tooth-like patterns, each one reminiscent of a saw blade. Earless Jax had bought blue and white paint and drawn designs across the orange armor. Each member of Bridge 4 carried a large wooden shield, strapped, tightly now, with red Parshendi bones. Ribs, for the most part, shaped in spiral patterns. Some of the men had tied finger bones to the centers, so they would rattle, and others had attached protruding sharp ribs to the sides of their helms, giving them the look of fangs or mandibles. The onlookers watched with amazement. It wasn't the first time they'd seen this armor, but this would be the first run where every man of Bridge 4 had it. Altogether, it made an impressive sight. 10 days with 6 bridge runs had allowed Kaladin and his team to perfect their method. 5 men to be decoys, with 5 more in the front holding shields and using only one arm to support the bridge. Their numbers were augmented by the wounded they'd saved from other crews, now strong enough to help carry. So far, despite 6 bridge runs, there hadn't been a single fatality. The other bridgemen were whispering about a miracle. Kaladin didn't know about that. He just made certain to keep a full pouch of infused spheres with him at all times. Most of the Parshendi archers seemed to focus on him. Somehow they could tell that he was the center of all this. They reached their bridge and formed up, shields strapped to rods on the sides to await use. As they hefted their bridge, a spontaneous round of cheering rose up from the other crews.
"That's new," Teft said from Kaladin's left.
"Guess they finally realized what we are," Kaladin said.
"And what's that?"
Kaladin settled the bridge onto his shoulders.
"We're their champions."
"Bridge forward!"
They broke into a trot, leading the way down from the staging yard, ushered by cheers.
"My father is not insane," Adolin thought, alive with energy and excitement as his armorers strapped on his shard plate. Adolin had stewed over Navani's revelation for days. He'd been wrong in such a horrible way. Dalinar Kholin wasn't growing weak. He wasn't getting senile. He wasn't a coward.
Dalinar had been right, and Adolin had been wrong. After much soul-searching, Adolin had come to a decision. He was glad that he'd been wrong. He grinned, flexing the fingers of his plated hand as the armorers moved to his other side. He didn't know what the visions meant or what the implications of those visions would be. His father was some kind of prophet, and that was daunting to consider. But for now, it was enough that Dalinar was not insane. It was time to trust him. Stormfather knew Dalinar had earned that right from his sons. The armorers finished with Adolin's shardplate. As they stepped away, Adolin hurried out of the armoring room into the sunlight, adjusting to the combined strength, speed, and weight of the shardplate. Niter and five other members of the Cobalt Guard hastened up, one bringing Sureblood to him. Adolin took the reins, but led the Rashadium at first, wanting more time to adapt to his plate. They soon entered the staging area. Adolin's father, in his shard plate, was conferring with Teleb and Ilamar. He seemed to tower over them as he pointed eastward. Already, companies of soldiers were moving out onto the lip of the plains. Adolin strode up to his father, eager. In the distance, he noticed a figure riding down along the eastern rim of the war camps. The figure wore gleaming red shard plate.
"Father?" Adolin said, pointing. "What's he doing here? Shouldn't he be waiting for us to ride to his camp?"
Dalinar looked up. He waved for a groom to bring Gallant, and the two of them mounted. They rode down to intercept Sadeus, trailed by a dozen members of the Cobalt Guard. Did Sadeus want to call off the assault? Was he worried about failing against the tower again? Once they drew close, Dalinar pulled up.
"You should be moving, Sadeus. Speed will be important if we're to get to the plateau before the Parshendi take the Gemheart and go."
The High Prince nodded.
"Agreed, in part. But we need to confer first. Dalinar, this is the tower we're assaulting."
He seemed eager.
"Yes, and?" "Damnation, man," Sadeus said. "You're the one who told me we needed to find a way to trap a large force of Parshendi on a plateau. The tower is perfect. They always bring a large force there, and two sides are inaccessible."
Adolin found himself nodding.
"Yes," he said. "Father, he's right. If we can box them in and hit them hard..."
The Parshendi normally fled when they took large losses. That was one of the things extending the war so long.
"It could mean a turning point in the war," Sadeus said, eyes alight. "My scribes estimate that they have no more than 20 or 30,000 troops left. The Parshendi will commit 10,000 here. They always do. But if we can corner and kill all of them, we could nearly destroy their ability to wage war on these plains."
"It'll work, Father," Adolin said eagerly. "This could be what we've been waiting for, what you've been waiting for. A way to turn the war, a way to deal enough damage to the Parshendi that they can't afford to keep fighting."
"We need troops, Dalinar," Sadeus said.
"Lots of them. How many men could you field, at a maximum?"
"On short notice," Dalinar said. 8,000, perhaps." "It will have to do," Sadeus said. "I've managed to mobilize about 7,000. We'll bring them all. Get your 8,000 to my camp, and we'll take every one of my bridge crews and march together. The Parshendi will get there first. It's inevitable with a plateau that close to their side. But if we can be fast enough, we can corner them on the plateau. Then we'll show them what a real Alethi army is capable of."
"I won't risk lives on your bridges, Sadeus," Dalinar said. "I don't know that I can agree to a completely joint assault."
"Bah," Sadeus said. "I've got a new way of using bridgemen, one that doesn't use nearly as many lives. Their casualties have dropped to almost nothing."
"Really?" Dalinar said. "Is it because of those bridgemen with armor? What made you change?"
Sadeus shrugged.
"Perhaps you're getting through to me. Regardless, we need to go now, together. With as many troops as they'll have, I can't risk engaging them and waiting for you to catch up. I want to go together and assault as closely together as we can manage. If you're still worried about the bridgemen, I can attack first and gain a foothold.
then let you cross without risking Bridgman lives.
Dalinar looked thoughtful.
Come on, father, Adolin thought. You've been waiting for a chance to hit the Parshendi hard. This is it.
Very well, Dalinar said. Adolin, send messengers to mobilize the 4th through 8th divisions. Prepare the men to march. Let's end this war.
The Tower.
I see them. They are the rocks. They are the vengeful spirits. Eyes of red.
Kakakis, 1173. 8 seconds pre-death. A dark-eyed young woman of 15. Subject was reportedly mentally unstable since childhood. Several hours later, Dalinar stood with Satius on a rock formation overlooking the tower itself. It had been a hard, long march. This was a distant plateau, as far eastward as they had ever struck. Plateaus beyond this point were impossible to take. The Parshendi could arrive so quickly that they had the Gemheart out before the Alethi arrived. Sometimes that happened with the tower as well. Dalinar searched.
I see it, he said, pointing. They don't have the Gemheart out yet.
A ring of Parshendi were pounding on the chrysalis. Its shell was like thick stone, however. It was still holding.
You should be glad you're using my bridges, old friend.
Satius shaded his face with a gauntleted hand.
Those chasms might be too wide for a shardbearer to jump.
Dalinar nodded. The tower was enormous. Even its huge size on the maps didn't do it justice. Unlike other plateaus, it wasn't level. Instead, it was shaped like an enormous wedge that dipped toward the west, pointing a large cliff face in the stormward direction. It was too steep, and the chasms too wide, to approach from the east or south. Only 3 adjacent plateaus could provide staging areas for assaults, all along the western or northwestern side. The chasms between these plateaus were unusually large, almost too wide for the bridges to span. On the nearby staging plateaus, thousands upon thousands of soldiers in blue or red were gathered, one color per plateau. Combined, they made for a larger force than Dalinar had ever seen brought against the Parshendi. The Parshendi numbers were as large as anticipated. There were at least 10,000 of them lining up. This would be a full-scale battle, the kind Dalinar had been hoping for, the kind that would let them pit a huge number of Alethi against a large Parshendi force. This could be it. The turning point in the war. Win this day and everything would change. Dalinar shaded his eyes as well, helm under his arm. He noted with satisfaction that Satius's scouting crews were crossing to adjacent plateaus, where they could watch for Parshendi reinforcements. Just because the Parshendi had brought so many at first, didn't mean that there were no other Parshendi forces waiting to flank them. Dalinar and Satius wouldn't be taken by surprise again.
Come with me, Satius said. Let us assault them together. A single grand wave of attack across 40 bridges.
Dalinar looked down at the bridge crews. Many of their members were lying exhausted on the plateau, awaiting, likely dreading, their next task. Very few of them wore the armor Satius had spoken of. Hundreds of them would be slaughtered in the assault if they attacked together. But was that any different from what Dalinar did? Asking his men to charge into battle to seize the plateau? Weren't they all part of the same army? The cracks. He wouldn't let them get wider. If he was going to be with Navani, he had to prove to himself he could remain firm in the other areas.
No, he said. I will attack, but only after you've made a landing point for my bridge crews. Even that is more than I should allow. Never force your men to do as you yourself would not.
You do charge the Parshendi.
I'd never do it carrying one of those bridges, Dalinar said. I'm sorry, old friend. It's not a judgment of you. It's what I must do.
Satius shook his head, pulling on his helmet.
Well, it will have to do. We still planning on dining together tonight to discuss strategy?
I assume so, unless Elokar has a fit for both of us missing his feast.
Sadeus snorted.
He's going to have to grow accustomed to it. 6 years of feasting every night is growing tedious. Besides, I doubt he'll feel anything but elation after we win this day, and leave the Parshendi down a full third of their soldiers. See you on the battlefield.
Dalinar nodded, and Sadeus jumped off the rock formation, dropping down to the surface below and joining his officers. Dalinar lingered, looking over at the tower. It was not only larger than most plateaus, it was rougher, covered with lumpish rock formations of hardened creme. The patterns were rolling and smooth, yet very uneven, like a field full of short walls covered by a blanket of snow. The southeastern tip of the plateau rose to a point overlooking the plains. The two plateaus they'd use were on the middle of the west side. Sadeus would take the northern one, and Dalinar would assault from one just below it, once Sadeus had cleared a landing for him.
We need to push the Parshendi to the southeast, Dalinar thought, rubbing his chin. Corner them there.
Everything hinged on that. The chrysalis was up near the top, so the Parshendi were already situated in a good position for Dalinar and Sadeus to push them back against the cliff edge. The Parshendi would probably allow this, as it would give them the high ground. If a second Parshendi army came, it would be separated from the others. The Alethi could focus on the Parshendi trapped atop the tower, while holding a defensive formation against the new arrivals. It would work. He felt himself growing excited. He hopped down to a shorter outcropping, then walked down a few step-like clefts to reach the plateau floor, where his officers waited. He then rounded the rock formation, investigating Adolin's progress. The young man stood in his shard plate, directing the companies as they crossed Sadeus's mobile bridges onto the southern staging plateau. In the near distance, Sadeus's men were forming up for the assault. That group of armored bridgemen stood out, preparing at the front center of the formation of bridge crews. Why were they allowed armor? Why not all the others as well? It looked like Parshendi carapace. Dalinar shook his head. The assault began, bridge crews running out ahead of Sadeus's army, approaching the tower first.
Where would you like to make our assault, Father? Adolin asked, summoning his shard blade and resting it on his pauldron, sharp side up.
There, Dalinar said, pointing to a spot on their staging plateau. Get the men ready. Adolin nodded, shouting the orders. In the distance, bridgemen began to die.
Heralds guide your paths, you poor men, Dalinar thought. As well as my own.
Kaladin danced with the wind. Arrows streamed around him, passing close, nearly kissing him with their painted scragglebark fletching. He had to let them get close, had to make the Parshendi feel they were near to killing him. Despite four other bridgemen drawing their attention, despite the other men of Bridge Four behind, armored with the skeletons of fallen Parshendi, most of the archers focused on Kaladin. He was a symbol, a living banner to destroy. Kaladin spun between arrows, slapping them away with his shield. A storm raged inside him, as if his blood had been sucked away and replaced with storm winds. It made his fingertips tingle with energy. Ahead, the Parshendi sang their angry, chanting song, the song for one who blasphemed against their dead. Kaladin stayed at the front of the decoys, letting the arrows fall close, daring them, taunting them, demanding they kill him until the arrows stopped falling and the wind stilled. Kaladin came to rest, breath held to contain the storm within. The Parshendi reluctantly fell back before Sadeus's force. An enormous force, as far as plateau assaults went. Thousands of men and 32 bridges. Despite Kaladin's distraction, 5 bridges had been dropped, the men carrying them slaughtered. None of the soldiers rushing across the chasm had made any specific effort to attack the archers firing on Kaladin, but the weight of numbers had forced them away. A few gave Kaladin loathing gazes, making an odd gesture by cupping a hand to the right ear and pointing at him before finally retreating. Kaladin released his breath, stormlight pulsing away from him. He had to walk a very fine line, drawing in enough stormlight to stay alive, but not so much that it was visible to the watching soldiers. The tower rose ahead of him, a slab of stone that dipped toward the west. The chasm was so wide that he'd worried the men would drop the bridge into the chasm as they tried to place it. On the other side, Sadeus had arrayed his forces in a cupping shape, pushing the Parshendi back away, trying to give Dalinar an opening. Perhaps attacking this way served to protect Dalinar's pristine image. He wouldn't make Bridgman die. Not directly, at least. Never mind that he stood on the backs of the men who had fallen to get Sadeus across. Their corpses were his true bridge.
Kaladin!
A voice called from behind. Kaladin spun. One of his men was wounded.
Storm it,
he thought, dashing up to Bridge 4. There was enough stormlight still pulsing in his veins to stave off exhaustion. He'd grown complacent. 6 bridge runs without a casualty. He should have realized it couldn't last. He pushed through the collected bridgemen to find Scar on the ground, holding his foot, red blood seeping between his fingers.
Arrow in the foot, Scar said through gritted teeth. In the storming foot! Who gets hit in the foot?
Kaladin, Moash's voice said, urgent. The bridgeman split as Moash brought Teft in, an arrow sprouting from his shoulder between carapace, breastplate, and arm.
Storm it, Kaladin said, helping Moash set Teft down.
The older bridgeman looked dazed. The arrow had dug deep into the muscle.
Somebody get pressure on Scar's foot and wrap it until I can look at it. Teft, can you hear me?
I'm sorry, lad,
Teft mumbled, eyes glassy.
You're all right,
Kaladin said, hurriedly taking some bandages from Lopin, then nodding grimly. Lopin would heat a knife for cauterizing.
Who else? Everyone else is accounted for,
Drey said.
Teft was trying to hide his wound. He must have taken it when we were shoving the bridge across.
Kaladin pressed gauze against the wound, then gestured for Lopin to hurry with the heated knife.
I want our scouts watching. Make sure the Parshendi don't try a stunt like they did a few weeks back. If they jump across that plateau to get at Bridge 4, we're dead.
He's all right, Rock said, shading his eyes. Sadeus is keeping his men in this area. No Parshendi will get through.
The knife came, and Kaladin held it hesitantly, a curl of smoke rising from its length. Teft had lost too much blood. There was no risking a sewing. But with the twist of the knife, Kaladin risked some bad scarring. That could leave the aging bridgeman with a stiffness that would hurt his ability to wield a spear. Reluctantly, Kaladin pressed the knife into the wound, the flesh hissing and blood drying to black crisps. Pain spren wiggled out of the ground, sinewy and orange. In a surgery, you could sew. But on the field, this was often the only way.
I'm sorry, Teft.
He shook his head as he continued to work. Men began to scream. Arrows hit wood and flesh, sounding like distant woodsmen swinging axes. Dalinar waited beside his men, watching Sadeus's soldiers fight.
He had better give us an opening, he thought. I'm starting to hunger for this plateau.
Fortunately, Sadeus quickly gained his footing on the tower and sent a flanking force over to carve out a section of land for Dalinar. They didn't get entirely into place before Dalinar started moving.
One of you bridges, come with me,
he bellowed, barreling to the forefront. He was followed by one of the 8 bridge teams Sadeus had lent him. Dalinar needed to get onto that plateau. The Parshendi had noticed what was happening and had begun to put pressure on the small company in green and white that Sadeus had sent to defend his entry area.
Bridge crew, there,
Dalinar said, pointing. The bridgemen hustled into place, looking relieved that they wouldn't be asked to place their bridge under fire of arrows. As soon as they got it into position, Dalinar charged across, the kobold guard following. Just ahead, Sadeus's men broke. Dalinar bellowed, closing his gauntleted hands around Oathbringer's hilt as the sword formed from mist. He crashed into the surging Parshendi line with a wide, two-handed sweep that dropped 4 men. The Parshendi began to chant in their strange language, singing their war song. Dalinar kicked a corpse aside and began to attack in earnest, frantically defending the foothold Sadeus's men had gained him. Within minutes, his soldiers surged around him. With the Cobalt Guard watching his back, Dalinar waded into the battle, breaking enemy ranks as only a Shardbearer could. He tore pockets through the Parshendi front lines, like a fish leaping from a stream, cutting back and forth, keeping his enemies disorganized. Corpses with burned eyes and slashed clothing made a trail behind him. More and more Lethi troops filled in the holes. Adolin crashed through a group of Parshendi nearby, his own squad of Cobalt Guardsmen a safe distance behind. He brought his whole army across. He needed to ascend quickly, pinning the Parshendi back so they couldn't escape. Sadeus was to watch the northern and western edges of the tower. The rhythm of the battle sang to Dalinar. The Parshendi chanting, the soldiers grunting and yelling, the shard blade in his hands and the surging power of the plate. The thrill rose within him. Since the nausea didn't strike him, he carefully let the blackthorn free, and felt the joy of dominating a battlefield and the disappointment of lacking a worthy foe. Where were the Parshendi shardbearers? He had seen that one in battle weeks ago. Why had he not reappeared? Would they commit so many men to the tower without sending a shardbearer? Something heavy hit his armor, banging off it, causing a small puff of stormlight to escape between the joints along his upper arm. Dalinar cursed, raising an arm to protect his face while scanning the near distance. There, he thought, picking out a nearby rock formation where a group of Parshendi stood swinging enormous rock slings with two hands. The head-sized stones crashed into Parshendi and Alethi alike, though Dalinar was obviously the target. He growled as another one hit, smashing against his forearm, sending a soft jolt through the shard plate. The blow was strong enough to send a small array of cracks through his right vambrace. Dalinar growled and threw himself into a plate-enhanced run. The thrill surged more strongly through him, and he rammed his shoulder into a group of Parshendi, scattering them, then spun with his blade and cut down those too slow to get out of his way. He dodged to the side as a hail of stones fell where he'd been standing, then leaped onto a low boulder. He took two steps and jumped for the ledge where the rock throwers were standing. He grabbed its edge with one hand, holding his blade with the other. The men atop the small ridge stumbled back, but Dalinar heaved himself up just high enough to swing. Oathbringer cut at their legs, and four men tumbled to the ground, feet dead. Dalinar dropped the blade, it vanished, and used both hands to heave himself onto the ridge. He landed in a crouch, plate clanking. Several of the remaining Parshendi tried to swing their slings, but Dalinar grabbed a pair of head-sized stones from a pile, easily palming them in his gauntleted hands, and flung them at the Parshendi. The stones hit with enough force to toss the slingmen off the formation, crushing their chests. Dalinar smiled, then began throwing more stones. As the last Parshendi fell off the ledge, Dalinar spun, summoning Oathbringer and looking over the battlefield. A spear wall of blue and reflective steel struggled against black and red Parshendi. Dalinar's men did well, pressing the Parshendi up to the southeast, where they would be trapped. Adolin led this effort, shardplate gleaming. Breathing deeply from the thrill now, Dalinar held his shardblade up above his head, reflecting sunlight. Below, his men cheered, sending up calls that rose above the Parshendi war chant. Glory spren sprouted around him. Stormfather, but it felt good to be winning again. He threw himself off the rock formation, for once not taking the slow and careful way down. He fell amid a group of Parshendi, crashing to the stones, blue stormlight rising from his armor. He spun, slaying, remembering years spent fighting alongside Gavilar. Winning. Conquering. He and Gavilar had created something during those years. A solidified, cohesive nation out of something fractured. Like master potters reconstructing a fine ceramic that had been dropped. With a roar, Dalinar cut through the line of Parshendi to where the Cobalt Guard was fighting to catch up to him.
"We press them,"
he bellowed.
"Pass the word. All companies up the side of the tower."
Soldiers raised spears and runners went to deliver his orders. Dalinar spun and charged into the Parshendi, pushing himself and his army forward. To the north, Sadeus's forces were stalled. Well, Dalinar's force would do the work for him. If Dalinar could spear forward here, he could slice the Parshendi in half, then crush the northern side against Sadeus and the southern side against the cliff edge. His army surged forward behind him, and the thrill bubbled within. It was power. Strength greater than shardplate. vitality greater than youth, skill greater than a lifetime of practice, a fever of power. Parshendi after Parshendi fell before his blade. He couldn't cut their flesh, yet he sheared through their ranks. The momentum of their attacks often carried their corpses stumbling past him even as their eyes burned. The Parshendi started to break, running away or falling back. He grinned behind his near-translucent visor. This was life. This was control. Gavilar had been the leader, the momentum, and the essence of their conquest. But Dalinar had been the warrior. Their opponents had surrendered to Gavilar's rule, but the Blackthorn, he was the man who had scattered them, the one who had dueled their leaders and slain their best shardbearers. Dalinar screamed at the Parshendi, and their entire line bent, then shattered. The Alethi surged forward, cheering. Dalinar joined his men, charging at their forefront to run down the fleeing Parshendi war pairs as they fled to the north or south, trying to join larger groups who held there. He reached a pair. One turned to hold him off with a hammer, but Dalinar cut him down in passing, then grabbed the other Parshendi and threw him down with a twist of the arm. Grinning, Dalinar raised his blade high over his head, looming over the soldier. The Parshendi rolled awkwardly, holding his arm, no doubt shattered as he was thrown down. He looked up at Dalinar, terrified, Fierce-Bren appearing around him. He was only a youth. Dalinar froze, blade held above his head, muscles taut. Those eyes, that face. Parshendi might not be human, but their features, their expressions were the same. Save for the marbled skin and the strange growths of carapace armor, this boy could have been a groom in Dalinar's stable. What did he see above him? A faceless monster in impervious armor? What was this youth's story? He would only have been a boy when Gavilar had been assassinated. Dalinar stumbled backward, the thrill vanishing. One of the Cobalt guardsmen passed by, casually ramming a sword into the Parshendi boy's neck. Dalinar raised a hand, but it was over too quickly for him to stop. The soldier didn't notice Dalinar's gesture. Dalinar lowered his hand. His men were rushing around him, rolling over the fleeing Parshendi. The majority of the Parshendi still fought, resisting Sadeus on one side and Dalinar's force on the other. The eastern plateau edge was just a short distance to Dalinar's right. He had come up against the Parshendi force like a spear, slicing it through the center, splitting it off to the north and south. Around him lay the dead. Many of them had fallen face down, taken in the back by spears or arrows from Dalinar's forces. Some Parshendi were still alive, though dying. They hummed or whispered to themselves a strange, haunting song, the one they sang as they waited to die. Their whispered songs rose like the curses of spirits on Soul's March. Dalinar had always found the death song the most beautiful of all he had heard from the Parshendi. It seemed to cut through the grunts, clangs, and screams of the nearby battle. As always, each Parshendi's song was in perfect time with that of his fellows. It was as if they could all hear the same melody somewhere far away, singing along through sputtering, bloodied lips with rasping breath. The codes, Dalinar thought, turning toward his fighting men. Never ask of your men a sacrifice you wouldn't make yourself. Never make them fight in conditions you would refuse to fight in yourself. Never ask a man to perform an act you wouldn't soil your own hands doing. He felt sick. This wasn't beautiful. This wasn't glorious. This wasn't strength, power, or life. This was revolting, repellent, and ghastly. But they killed Gavilar, he thought, searching for a way to overcome the sickness he suddenly felt. Unite them. Roshar had been united once. Had that included the Parshendi? You don't know if you can trust the visions or not, he told himself, his honor guard forming up behind him. They could be from the Night Watcher, or the Voidbringers, or something else entirely. In that moment, the objections felt weak. What had the visions wanted him to do? Bring peace to Alethkar, unite his people, act with justice and honor. Could he not judge the visions based on those results? He raised his shard blade to his shoulder, walking solemnly among the fallen toward the northern line, where the Parshendi were trapped between his men and Sadeus's. His sickness grew stronger, What was happening to him?
Father!
Adolin's shout was frantic. Dalinar turned toward his son, who was running to him. The young man's plate was sprayed with Parshendi blood, but as always his blade gleamed.
What do we do?
Adolin asked, panting.
About what?
Dalinar asked. Adolin turned, pointing to the west, toward the plateau south of the one from which Dalinar's army had begun their assault over an hour ago. There, leaping across the wide chasm, was an enormous second army of Parshendi. Dalinar slammed his visor up, fresh air washing across his sweaty face. He stepped forward. He'd anticipated this possibility, but someone should have given warning. Where were the scouts? What was... He felt a chill. Shaking, he scrambled toward one of the smooth, bulging formations of rock that were plentiful on the tower.
Father?
Adolin said, running after him. Dalinar climbed, seeking the top of the formation, dropping his shard blade. He crested the rise and stood looking northward over his troops and the Parshendi. Northward, toward Sadeus. Adolin climbed up beside him, gauntleted hand slapping up his visor.
Oh, no,
he whispered. Sadeus's army was retreating across the chasm to the northern staging plateau. Half of it was across already. The 8 groups of bridgemen he'd lent Dalinar had pulled back and were gone. Sadeus was abandoning Dalinar and his troops, leaving them surrounded on 3 sides by Parshendi, alone on the shattered plains. And he was taking all of his bridges with him. Codes 66. Codes.
That chanting, that singing, those rasping voices.
Katak, 1173, 16 seconds pre-death. A middle-aged potter. Reported seeing strange dreams during high storms during the last 2 years. Kaladin wearily unwrapped Scar's wound to inspect his stitches and change the bandage. The arrow had hit on the right side of the ankle, deflecting off the knob of the fibula and scraping down through the muscles on the side of the foot.
You're very lucky, Scar, Kaladin said, putting on the new bandage. You'll walk on this again, assuming you do not put weight on it until it's healed. We'll have some of the men carry you back to camp.
Behind them, the screaming, pounding, pulsing battle raged on. The fighting was distant now, focused on the eastern edge of the plateau. To Kaladin's right, Teft drank as Lopin poured water into his mouth. The older man scowled, taking the water skin from Lopin with his good hand.
I'm not an invalid, he snapped.
He'd gotten over his initial dizziness, though he was weak. Kaladin sat back, feeling drained. When Stormlight faded away, it left him exhausted. That should pass soon. It had been over an hour since the initial assault. He carried a few more infused spheres in his pouch. He forced himself to resist the urge to suck in their light. He stood up, meaning to gather some men to carry Scar and Teft toward the far side of the plateau, just in case the battle went poorly and they had to retreat. That wasn't likely. The Alethi soldiers had been doing well the last time he'd checked. He scanned the battlefield again. What he saw made him freeze. Sadeus was retreating. At first it seemed so impossible that Kaladin couldn't accept it. Was Sadeus bringing his men around to attack in another direction? But no, the rear guard was already across the bridges, and Sadeus's banner was approaching. Was the High Prince wounded?
Dre, Layton, grab Scar. Rock and Pete, you take Teft. Hustle to the western side of the plateau in preparation to flee. The rest of you, get into bridge positions.
The men, only now noticing what was going on, responded with anxiety.
Moash, you're with me,
Kaladin said, hastening toward their bridge. Moash hurried up beside Kaladin.
What's going on?
Sadeus is pulling out, Kaladin said,
watching the tide of Sadeus's men in green slide away from the Parshendi lines like wax melting.
There's no reason to. The battle's barely begun, and his forces are winning. I can only think that Sadeus must have been wounded.
Why would they withdraw the entire army for that? Moash said.
You don't think he is... His banner still flies, Kaladin said. So he's probably not dead, unless they left it up to keep the men from panicking.
He and Moash reached the side of the bridge. Behind, the rest of the crew hastened to form a line. Matal was on the other side of the chasm, speaking with the commander of the rear guard. After a quick exchange, Matal crossed and began to run down the line of bridge crews, calling for them to prepare to carry. He glanced at Kaladin's team, but saw they were already ready, and so hurried on. To Kaladin's right, on the adjacent plateau, the one where Dalinar had launched his assault, the 8 Lent bridge crews pulled away from the battlefield, crossing over to Kaladin's plateau. A light-eyed officer Kaladin didn't recognize was giving them orders. Beyond them, farther to the southwest, a new Parshendi force had arrived and was pouring onto the tower. Sadeus rode up to the chasm. The paint on his shardplate gleamed in the sun. It didn't bear a single scratch. In fact, his entire honor guard was unharmed. Though they had gone over to the tower, they had disengaged the enemy and come back. Why? And then Kaladin saw it. Dalinar Kolin's force, fighting on the upper middle slope of the wedge, was now surrounded. This new Parshendi force was flooding into sections that Sadeus had held, supposedly protecting Dalinar's retreat.
They're abandoning him, Kaladin said. This was a trap, a setup. Sadeus is leaving High Prince Kolin, and all of his soldiers, to die.
Kaladin scrambled around the edge of the bridge, pushing through the soldiers who were coming off it. Moash cursed and followed. Kaladin wasn't certain why he elbowed his way up to the next bridge, Bridge 10, where Sadeus was crossing. Perhaps he needed to see for certain that Sadeus wasn't wounded. Perhaps he was still stunned. This was treachery on a grand scale. Terrible enough that it made Amaram's betrayal of Kaladin seem almost trivial. Sadeus trotted his horse across the bridge, the wood clattering. He was accompanied by 2 light-eyed men in regular armor, and all 3 had their helms under their arms as if they were on parade. The honor guard stopped Kaladin, looking hostile. He was still close enough to see that Sadeus was, indeed, completely unharmed. He was also close enough to study Sadeus's proud face as he turned his horse and looked back at the tower. The 2nd Parshendi army swarmed Kolin's army, trapping them. Even without that, Kolin had no bridges. He could not retreat.
I told you, old friend, Sadeus said, voice soft but distinct, overlapping the distant screams. I said that honor of yours would get you killed someday.
He shook his head. Then he turned his horse, trotting it away from the battlefield. Dalinar cut down a Parshendi war pair. There was always another to replace it. He set his jaw, falling into wind stance, and taking the defensive, holding his little rise in the hillside and acting as a rock over which the oncoming Parshendi wave would have to break. Sadeus had planned this retreat well. His men hadn't been having trouble. They'd been ordered to fight in a way that they could easily disengage. And he had a full 40 bridges to retreat across. Together, that made his abandonment of Dalinar happen quickly, by the scale of battles. Though Dalinar had immediately ordered his men to push forward, hoping to catch Sadeus while the bridges were still set, he hadn't been nearly quick enough. Sadeus's bridges were pulling away, the entirety of his army now across. Adolin fought nearby. They were 2 tired men in plate, facing an entire army. Their armor had accumulated a frightening number of cracks. None were critical yet, but they did leak precious stormlight. Wisps of it rose like the songs of dying Parshendi.
I warned you not to trust him,
Adolin bellowed as he fought, cutting down a pair of Parshendi, then taking a wave of arrows from a team of archers who had set up nearby. The arrows sprayed against Adolin's armor, scratching the paint. One caught in a crack, widening it.
I told you,
Adolin continued to yell, lowering his arm from his face and slicing into the next pair of Parshendi just before they landed their hammers on him.
I said he was an eel.
I know,
Dalinar yelled back.
We walked right into this,
Adolin continued, shouting as if he hadn't heard Dalinar.
We let him take away our bridges,
We let him get us onto the plateau before the second wave of Parshendi arrived. We let him control the scouts. We even suggested the attack pattern that would leave us surrounded if he didn't support us.
I know.
Dalinar's heart twisted inside of him. Sadeus was carrying out a premeditated, carefully planned, and very thorough betrayal. Sadeus hadn't been overwhelmed, hadn't retreated for safety, though that was undoubtedly what he would claim when he got back to camp. A disaster, he'd say. Parshendi everywhere. Attacking together had upset the balance, and, unfortunately, he'd been forced to pull out and leave his friend. Oh, perhaps some of Sadeus's men would talk, tell the truth, and other high princes would undoubtedly know what really happened. But nobody would challenge Sadeus openly. Not after such a decisive and powerful maneuver. The people in the war camps would go along with it. The other high princes were too displeased with Dalinar to raise a fuss. The only one who might speak up was Elokar, and Sadeus had his ear. It wrenched Dalinar's heart. Had it all been an act? Could he really have misjudged Sadeus so completely? What of the investigation clearing Dalinar? What of their plans and reminiscences? All lies?
I saved your life, Sadeus.
Dalinar watched Sadeus's banner retreat across the staging plateau. Among that distant group, a rider who wore crimson shardplate turned and looked back. Sadeus, watching Dalinar fighting for his life. That figure paused for a moment, then turned around and rode on. The Parshendi were surrounding the forward position where Dalinar and Adolin fought just ahead of the army. They were overwhelming his guard. He jumped down and slew another pair of enemies, but earned another blow to his forearm in the process. The Parshendi swarmed around him, and Dalinar's guard began to buckle.